Welcome to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Driven to Business is a business forum program that focuses on success principles in business. And now, it's time for Driven to Business.
Good morning and welcome to another edition of Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. We're glad you're here. If you're just somewhere about to get out of your car, we're streaming live on biz1190.com. Today's program will be podcast on eddiemayfield.com. We have a great guest today. Dr. David Cooper is the lead pastor at Mount Perrin Church here in the Atlanta area, and he's also an author of a number of books, most recently a book here called Unfinished Business. He's also a musician. In fact, has a CD out called Flying Solo. You can find both of those on Amazon. Dr. Cooper, welcome to Driven to Business.
Thank you, Ed. It's good to be with you this morning.
David, you're a pastor, you're a counseling psychologist, and aside from preaching to a very large congregation, you're an in-demand speaker, and as I just learned actually this week, a very good musician as well. Now, your latest book is called Unfinished Business. That's an interesting title. Tell us about that.
It's about issues of the past that we haven't really resolved that are still influencing the present. It's about understanding how past issues and things that have shaped us in the past continue to impact the present.
You know, David, I grew up with three brothers and no sisters, and the environment of that sort of very male, rough and tumble environment was a sort of don't ever let them see you bleed kind of you know situation.
Right.
So I learned early on to, at least in front of my brothers, to sort of suppress emotions. Now, I think a lot of my friends would like to know the answer to this, and you're both a pastor and a psychologist. Does that mean I'm nuts?
Absolutely not. There are times to suppress at least the expression of emotion so that we have some discretion. You know, we all live in relationships, and we have to have a certain discretion
right
as to how we express our emotions. But being aware of what we feel, being able to identify what we feel, and then if we have negative emotions where we're angry or we're upset or we're deeply depressed, if we suppress those and don't express them, they can drive us into revenge, resentment, deep depression. So being aware of our emotions, being able to talk to somebody about them, being able to be honest about them, be able to express them so that they don't end up shaping who we are. A person, for example, that suppresses anger for years,
right,
ends up becoming an angry person, whether the predominant face they wear is angry. If you say, well, what are you angry at? They may not be able to identify it that day, but over time, they have really developed a posture of anger towards the world, where if we get angry, that's normal and natural, but we should get over that quickly so that it doesn't become an entrenched part of who we are.
You know, David, I heard you say in another interview that anger, this is sort of an interesting thing to me, that anger actually is a God-given emotion.
Absolutely. There are 455 references to the word anger in the Bible. 375 refer to the anger of God. So if God is angry, we know that God's perfect. So anger in and of itself is a natural emotion. Now, God's anger is perfect. Ours is often tainted by our sinfulness, and it comes out in some very ugly ways. But the feeling of displeasure, which is what anger is, it can be a positive emotion that motivates us to change, to take action. It's just important to not let that become entrenched so that it turns into other things like deep-seated bitterness or resentment. We start striking back, or we gossip, or we tear others down. To get that anger out, express it, understand it's a normal part of life. But anger is something that's good for a very short time. It says in Psalm 30, verse 5, the anger of the Lord lasts only a moment.
Right.
But then it says in the 100th Psalm, his mercy endures forever. So the predominant quality of our lives should be mercy toward others. If we're angry, that's fine, but we need to let it last a moment and get over it.
You know, I am not what I would consider an angry person. In fact, I rarely get angry. But I had an interesting experience, you know, just driving my car. I wasn't even thinking about your book or about you. I was driving the car, and for some reason, I started thinking about an incident that happened when I was a little kid of an older boy taunting me. And just riding along, I suddenly found myself mad about that again and sort of getting all upset about it. And then you sort of stop and have this talk with yourself. Well, what is wrong with you? I don't even remember that kid's name. Why am I mad about that?
because of memory. We're discovering in psychology that feeling and thought are the same thing in the mind as opposed to two different things. And the reason that we remember certain things over others is because they had a strong feeling attached to it. It's like when a song comes on the radio, it kind of takes you back to a place you were in high school, college, or work. But there's a feeling with it. And the reason we remember certain experiences is because it had a strong feeling. And the reason you remember that thing is because you were so angry and upset, and you might have felt powerless to do anything about it. And that's why that memory is still with you.
I think you're right. You know, James Dobson, in a book that he wrote, I forgot the exact title of it, but it was dealing with marriage. And he talked about married couples, and he used a term that in some marriages there are ghosts living in the house with the married couple. And what he's referring to there is if one of them has been perhaps abused by a father or mother or a sibling or something of that sort, or had some very disruptive relationship in their life, and that although they don't think about it much, that the ghost of that incident or prolonged pattern of abuse or whatever is in that house, and that young it affects the relationship of that marriage, of that young couple's marriage. And he was suggesting that of course in his mind that they learn to get over that, you know, get past that.
Well, I think that's what I meant, Mona. I said becoming aware of what we feel. A lot of times when I'm talking to people and going through issues, I will say, well, how do you feel, or how does it make you feel? And they actually have a hard time even coming up with a feeling word.
Right.
People, for example, say, well, I feel confused. And I say, well, confusion is more of a way of thinking. Since you can think a little bit more about that, what kind of emotions, you can come up with a feeling word. A lot of times we're not even aware of what we feel. Becoming aware of it and then being able to talk to somebody about it. Being able to talk about things is so therapeutic. Like in James 5:16, it says, therefore confess your faults one to another, so that you may be healed. Now, the word fault there in the Greek is paroptima, which means more of a stumbling, a falling, a mistake. It's not even about moral transgressions. I guess it could be about that. But it's the idea that confession or talking with someone is connected to healing. Is there, you know, therefore, you are healed and pray for each other. The fact that we can talk about things with someone who is safe and share and explore those feelings or experiences of abuse or neglect gives us a sense of empowerment. When people don't know why they're upset, why they're afraid, why they don't trust, they feel like they're the slave of the past. But when they can pull it out and identify and say, I was abused, I know what happened to me, I understand it, I forgive that person, they end up having a sense of empowerment over the past as opposed to feeling controlled by forces they don't understand.
I think, David, perhaps, at least in my experience, both at church and in business and everywhere else, we men seem to have a more difficult time with that, perhaps, than women do. Do you agree with that?
Maybe. I'm not much into the stereotypes of men and women, although I think there's some fundamental differences. There certainly are physiological differences in the brain of men and women, which tends to make the species a little different. I don't know, you think about some of the great artists in the world, musicians, songs, a lot of those have deep emotions, so a lot of great artists are men. Maybe in common talk, everyday talk, it may not be as cool for men to sit around a table at a restaurant and talk about their deepest secrets as women, so that may be that we're more guarded, perhaps.
I think, you know, going back again to childhood, you know, one of the worst things you could be called when I was a kid was a crybaby, you know, which is just another way of saying whiner. You know, that's something that at least where I grew up, that was something you did not want to be labeled as a crybaby.
Right. I grew up like that, too. You know, you have to take it and man up and all that kind of
thing. Exactly right. You know, David, in a business environment, I have to deal with employees, and I know it's no different for you as a pastor. You deal with employees and perhaps even more difficultly, in a more difficult sense, with the people who are volunteers and congregation and church members, things of that sort. And, you know, I used to think a long time ago that I used to think, you know, personal life is personal life and business life is business life. And if a person's having problems in their personal life, they just need to get over it and do their job. I have learned through the years that while no matter how bad you may want it that way, that's not how it is. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree with that. I also agree that not everybody's like us, and we have the tendency to think, well, this is the way I manage it, this is how I deal with things, so everybody should do that.
Right.
And it's instead of saying, well, my style is different than yours, I respect yours, it's not, you know, it's not my thing, but like for me, example, when I get up every morning, it's a new day. It doesn't matter if I was hurt, mad the day before. My nature is to just get over things and move on. Now, other people, they're more melancholy. They're going to stew on things. And, you know, I've learned to understand, well, that's who they are. I can't change that. I just need to understand that.
David, and we could perhaps talk about this past the break in a moment, but in your view, in the unfinished business, is there a type of unfinished business in people's lives that is more common than other types of unfinished business?
Yes. I think resentment is the most common. Things happen to us. We're hurt over it. We really don't know how to deal with it. We don't know how to confront the person. So we end up, that stuff stays with us for a long time. And the level of hurt is a lot deeper. And it tends us to, you know, it can happen. So a family member gets sick and dies. We resent God. Or we resent the doctors. We're not doing Medicare. We get fired from a job. We resent the people. We're treated unfairly. And our investments go under. We resent the financial advisor. The pastor preaches a sermon we don't like, you know, we resent him. It's, you know, it's so easy to get hurt and then not know what to do with it. Like if you get fired, what do you do with it? You just kind of walk away with all of those emotions. Or you go through a divorce, you don't want, there's no way to resolve it. You know, that's what hurts about divorce. People can't resolve, they feel things are unresolved. So the resentment is probably the most common form because we get hurt a lot and then we have no way of even dealing with it. So it piles up.
Well, you know, coming back after break, I actually want to ask you about how you, because you're right, we do end up feeling powerless, and a lot of us don't know what to do about that, and I'm interested in perhaps getting your advice on what people should do in that regard. You're listening to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield, and we will be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Driven to Business. We're talking with Dr. David Cooper from Mount Perrin Church. Dr. Cooper is an author. He's written a book recently called Unfinished Business, and you can find that on Amazon.com and I'm sure at many other places. Dr. Cooper, right before the break, we were talking about the idea that one of the most common forms of unfinished business or unresolved issues in people's lives is resentment, and one of the problems is that we don't know what to do with it. So as an expert in this area, what do we do?
Well, I'm not an expert, but I noticed in the break we heard the Eagles' Life in the Fast Lane.
Right.
That actually has a great lesson. The quicker you can confront your issues and just say, this is what I'm going through, and begin to deal with them, the better. One thing we can do with resentment is get it out. Now, if we get fired, for example, we can't really get it out to the company because we're fired. They don't care. But we can go talk to someone, a pastor, a friend, talk about how we feel. The second thing we can do is ask ourselves, what benefit is coming to me from resentment? I think looking at the payoff value is important. When people understand how the resentment begins to affect them negatively, they'll probably think, you know, I just don't want to stay there. And the third thing we can do is, you know, give it to God. Say, Lord, I've been hurt with this. Maybe I was treated unfairly, but I'm going to trust you to provide a new opportunity for me. And beginning to live by faith gets us looking in the future and expecting God to open a new opportunity that's better than what we lost. Focusing on where you're going is more important than continuing to focus on where you've been. Now, so you can't every day occupy your thoughts and your words on the past because that robs the energy of the present. So it's important to think about it, talk about it, but then make a quality decision and say, you know, that's over. I'm going to begin to look forward. My prayer life is not going to be about how I was hurt. My prayer life is going to be about, Lord, I'm trusting you to open a new opportunity for me. I've been hurt. I've been disappointed. But I'm going on to write a new chapter in my life.
You know, one of the things that that I have learned in my own life, and I've heard other people say this, is that, you know, one of the ways to get over hurt is to help somebody else. Like, you know, instead of focusing all the time on your own problems, find someone that needs help and do something for them that has a curative effect, or at least it does on me for some reason when I'm feeling down.
That's a great thing. I read a quote by a psychiatrist one time, and he said, if you feel depressed, you're just locked in your house. He said, you need to go out the front door, go across the street, find somebody in need. In other words, you're depressed, don't become the victim of it. Find some way to get outside of yourself. You know, go to church depressed. You know, go to work depressed. But don't allow the depression to put you in a prison.
You know, if you walk up the average person, and you know this better than me because you do a lot more counseling than certainly I do or will, but if you just walk up the average person who's having some problems and you say, what's wrong? Most of the time, and this would include me if you ask me, most of the time I'm going to say nothing. Why are we like that?
Well, I think it has to do with discretion. You know, we only open up to people we trust.
Right.
Like counseling, for example, the difference of a therapist and your friend giving you advice. A therapist is trained, first of all, in how to build a relationship of trust. And we understand that until the person who comes to see us has some level of trust, they're not going to open up. They're going to be guarded. That's a natural human tendency. You know, the survival of the organism is the first law of life, according to science. So we need to survive in a social world, and the way to easily lose friends is just tell everybody what you think. And what you know, you're going to be pretty much ice. Nobody's going to want to hang out with you. So until people trust us, they're not going to open up. And until we feel that it's in a safe environment, we're not really going to open up about things. And that's why it's important to build relationships at a deeper level that are beyond just business or associates, people that we feel like we can trust so that we don't have to live isolated. We can't open up and talk about anything, and nobody's going to judge us for it. Nobody's going to say, you shouldn't feel that way. That's what shuts down communication. When people say, and you can tell me anything, I love you, you know, I accept you, you know, I'm here to help you get through it. That's when we open up.
Yeah, and actually believe that, and I would think, and I think both of us probably know instances, even at church and in other close situations where that trust has been violated, perhaps even not meaning to violate it, and it really does.
That's right. I paid a lot of money at University of Georgia to get a counseling degree just to learn how to keep my mouth shut. You know, to learn the ethics and the legal boundaries of confidentiality.
Right.
So, and I thought, you know, everybody just ought to really go through courses like this just for life. It would help to just learn how to keep things confidential is so important, and yet it's something I don't think we by nature do. A lot of times we want to help people, so we tell everything, and it shuts down any honesty or any openness.
Right. Talk to us about the idea, and I think you discuss this in your book, the idea of the brain as an iceberg. You sort of give an analogy to that.
It's kind of a theory of Sigmund Freud about the unconscious. The brain, you know, stores memories over the lifetime, up to about 15 trillion memories. It stores all data. So most of the brain, like an iceberg, only a tip of it is above the surface of the water. The majority of an iceberg is below the water. Well, the memories of the brain, only a small part of your memories are conscious. You say 2 + 2 = 4. What is your name? This is information that I can retrieve at will.
Right.
And yet everything that happens to me is stored by the brain, so it stores it at an unconscious level. You say, what happened to you when you were 6? I go, not really sure.
Right.
Well, it's there, but those experiences, even though they may not be conscious to me today, the feelings, and sometimes they come out, like the story of you and the boy that, you know, hurt you. Sometimes they come out, but they're all there, but they continue to influence.
Yeah, I didn't even know I remember that.
Yeah. Freud called these unconscious motivators of behavior. I think it's an interesting phrase. There are things motivating my behavior today that I'm unaware that they're doing that. And, of course, his whole approach to therapy, which, you know, not everybody agrees with, but was to create an environment where people could begin to explore and get insight into things in the past that were influencing them in the present, keeping them from living a full life.
I don't know if you ever read Malcolm Gladwell at all. I enjoy him as an author, but he wrote a book called Blink. And what the book is about, it's interesting. It's about the process of decision making, and it could be any decision, pretty much, both a stressful decision like a military group in an ambush, down to deciding, you know, what to have for supper. And he's a meticulous researcher, and he went on and on about it. But he spent a lot of time, and what it boils down to is that a lot of times the longer you take to make a decision, per his thesis, doesn't necessarily mean you make a better decision. His point being that there are processes going on, as you talked about, beneath the surface of the brain that you are pretty much unaware of. that help you make decisions. And a lot of it, now you could also be trained to make bad decisions if you're not trained properly, you can make bad decisions based on that. But his idea is that you make decisions, often very good decisions, in the blink of an eye almost. But it's because your brain is operating at the subconscious level at a pretty fast level. It's a fascinating book and a fair amount of research for that. And in business, another thing that interests me a lot is selling and marketing and things of that sort. One of the most researched things there is on the earth, and I like doing it even as a Christian, because I always think it's the study of how God wired us up, which is, again, trying to understand that. And I think probably you feel that way as a psychologist as well. It's fascinating to look at how God wired us all up.
I think that's an interesting analogy. Now, it works for me because I'm a very intuitive person as opposed to an analytical person, and also I'm a very impulsive person. So that kind of theory was great for a guy like me. There is some study that if you were taking a test at school and you didn't know the answer, you had multiple choice, that usually your first impulse.
Right.
And the reason for that is you probably studied that material, and if you can't pull that answer up consciously, your mind unconsciously is recognized. So I think that the more people, I find that in talking to people, usually they know or often know the best thing to do, but they're afraid to do it. And they've been programmed to be afraid because of past failures, and that gets them paralyzed in analysis. The paralysis of analysis.
Hang on during the break here, Dr. Cooper. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Driven to Business. Let me remind you, we are streaming live on biz1190.com, being podcast on eddiemayfield.com and iTunes. And by the way, you can go to the iTunes store and download the Biz1190 app and put it right there on your iPhone and have us wherever you go. Our guest today is Dr. David Cooper of Mount Perry, and also the author of a brand new book called Unfinished Business. You can get that on Amazon.com. David, right before the break, we were beginning to talk about this paralysis of analysis thing. I felt like I cut you off, so let me let you finish up that thought.
Yeah, we analyze something, and then we analyze it, and we talk to people about it, and we have people pray with us. And we've gone beyond the point of kind of knowing in our gut the best decision to make. And
right.
The reason we do that is we're afraid of making the wrong decision. And that's usually because we've been hurt or things didn't work out. And the more we have bad experience, the more fearful we become and the less capable of making good decisions. But it doesn't take that long to get the information and to think it through and come up with a good decision. And a lot of decisions aren't good or bad. They're just decisions. And that's very liberating to know that, you know, I could choose one or two different things and either one would be equally well.
Right. There's a Zig Ziglar has a saying that I always like in business, the late Zig Ziglar. He always said, you know, no one ever stumbled over anything sitting down. You know, it occasionally... You just need to go. I mean, go do what you're supposed to do.
And I like that.
And do the best as you're going. Hey, I heard you on another interview. You were talking about leadership, and you were talking about leaders are those that look to the future, while managers are more about the here right. and now. Explain that.
A leader sees where they can go and people can go, the people that they're responsible to and for. They're always forward in their thinking. They see where we're going. A manager is a person, and leaders need managers that are doing the day-to-day work that needs to be done. You know, leaders, managers live with their feet on the ground. Managers kind of soar above the air. They have a different visual of things. They see things very different. The way you look down from an airplane and see the city right before you land. Leadership sees a much bigger picture. Management has its feet on the ground. It only sees what's in front of it
right.
today.
You know, the difference, and I alluded to this a little bit earlier, but you pastor a very large and complex, I would imagine, congregation over there at Mount Perry, and I'm not a pastor, but I'm very active in our church, and I've been in, you know, sort of several lay-type leadership positions. And the discussion often comes up sometimes, also small as an owner of a small business, the idea of the difference in leading volunteers versus leading paid employees. And in the first place, I'm going to tell you, I think sometimes too much difference is made of that. You know, you can, in this day and age, if you have a paid employee, you can only go so far with telling him what to do. You know, at some point, they're going to leave you. and back out. But there is, I have often thought it takes a lot more leadership ability, I think, for someone like a pastor who you're having to motivate people that you're not paying. And of course, you got God on your side, so that's maybe an unfair advantage. But you can you talk about that a little bit about the how you have motivating people in a church?
Well, I mean, other than the financial difference between the volunteer and a paid person, although I don't think money should ever be used as a motivator, so
right.
I would think differently from that.
It's a very poor motivator. I'll tell you that from experience.
Yeah, I don't use money to motivate. I don't think that's the purpose of money. I think it gives somebody a fair compensation for their job.
Right.
But their motivation should be their sense of calling, whether it's to the church or the business, whether their loyalty to the business owner or the minister or the vision of the church, whether they're serving the greater good of the business, the greater good of the church, or they're serving their own interests. So I'm not sure. There's no difference in the way I motivate people. When I have a total staff luncheon and take them to Papacito, something I never do is have a I don't have an appreciation luncheon for my staff at the church, because I think that doesn't give a lot. If I take them over here to Papacito's and take the total staff out, I mean, they go nuts over that. Just the fact that they're away from the church is something. The fact that it's different, the fact that I thought of something, or Barbie, my wife's a great plan, the fact that we thought of something nice for them means so much to them. Saying thank you a lot, like after a big service, after Easter, I'm always sending emails to people, personal emails, notes saying thank you for your hard work. I don't let things go unnoticed. And to me, that's a big motivator, doing a lot of little things for people to say thank you, that was great work. I think when people don't do a lot of encouraging, I think that's poor leadership. And I've worked with people that just didn't often say thank you or you're doing a great job. But for me, it's
right.
Something I do a lot for people.
I think that, you know, there's obviously just honestly saying thank you is one of the simplest ways to do it. And it goes a long way. Also, like you're saying, do things nice for somebody. Take them out for a nice meal or something to again,
absolutely,
show.
Absolutely, yes.
But I think, at least in both my church experience and in some, you know, civic club type experiences and at work, part of it is making people know that their contributions are valued, that you don't consider them being a robot. You're not micromanaging them. You know, you ask them to do a certain task, and then you there's always that balance between how much do you get involved with that? But you know, I've often said at our company, I don't want robots working there, so I want people who can think when I'm not there, and we're blessed with that in our company, and consequently, the great thing about it is they're happier that way too. You get better work, and they're much happier. The idea that you basically you're valuing them as people.
I think giving people the freedom to think, to dream, to take initiative is very empowering for people, and it shows a lot of respect for them to say, I'm not here to micromanage everything. I'm not telling you, I just want to get the job done. You may have a better way than I have to do it. I respect your way of doing things that are different than mine. That shows a lot of respect.
Right.
The word value and the word respect to me are the same.
That's a good point.
Because the word respect, the actual English word in its origin means to look at something and to see the beauty and value of it. That's respect. And I can see the value of not just the person, but the way the person works differently from me and say, that's not the way I do it, but it's interesting the way you do it, and that's just as valuable as the way I do it. But showing respect for people is how you value them.
David, what motivated you to write Unfinished Business? I don't mean to get personal, but did you see signs of unfinished business in your own life? Or perhaps just as a counselor, you see them in other people. Is that what motivated that?
Well, what motivated me to write that book is that I care about people.
Right.
That's the primary motivator of my life, is I actually care about people. That's the bottom line of everything I do, and whether it's, you know, preaching or giving a talk or counseling, or I'm involved in prison ministry with a band. I actually care about people. So my life is devoted to helping people live the best life they can live. If they're hurting, is there a way that I can help you get over that? Are you not seeing your potential? Is there a way that I can help you see how valuable you are? So everything I've ever written, messages I've shared, for me, it's all about picking people up. So, you know, as certainly as a counselor, I see the unfinished business. And I also kind of believe that's a defining part of who we are, and that people aren't aware of the fact that they are broken today because of what happened yesterday. And they're trying to only deal with the present, but they got some issues that have happened to them in the past right. that are crippling them in the present, and they need to become aware of that and realize they can shake those things off. They don't have to keep living like that. They can become a new person. Life is like writing a book. You end a chapter, you can always write a new chapter in your life. And I tell people that. You may be through the worst chapter of your life, but it's only a chapter. It's up to you whether that's the end of your book or not. You always have the power to write a whole new chapter.
That is such a good analogy, and I appreciate it. You know, my wife and I don't know where you guys are in this, but you know, we went through, you know, we had children, and you spend all the time with that, and then they go off, and so you sort of turn a chapter in the book of your life there, in your marriage and everything, and then of course grandkids, and they all come back home. But you know, there are these sort of books, and it's not that one chapter is worse or better than another; they just are different chapters, and you live life as God leads you in those. Within those chapters, David, are we as a society, just as a society, are we too introspective or not introspective enough?
Well, there's a lot of sociological and psychological research that says we're a very narcissistic culture, and we've become right. that. Although I think that has shifted a little bit, but the American culture is a very materialistic culture,
right?
And it is a culture that's very self-focused at times. And yet the American people are the most generous people in the world. Like if there's a storm somewhere or a hurricane, there's more generosity that comes out of the United States to help, you know, whether it's Haiti or wherever it is, China, they could have a tornado come through. And the American people are the most generous people financially. So there is a high level of introspection and materialism and self-centeredness. And yet, at the same time, we're also extremely generous.
I think I'm just finished reading a book about Lincoln, and it's not a complimentary book of Lincoln, which I really had a little bit of a hard time with right at first, to be honest, because I've always Lincoln sort of an American icon. But as I began to read and think about it, what it came to me, I was thinking about, you know, the truth of the matter is there are no perfect people. None of us are all good or all bad. We're sort of, you know, I can be the best guy in the world one day and a pretty miserable sucker the next day, you know, depending on what circumstances I find myself in or you know, I guess from a pastor's standpoint, we'd say sin in our lives. After the break, I want to talk to you just one more time about, I want to get another, I want to talk to you about your guitar. Number one, I'm pretty interested in that. And number two, I want to ask you for sort of a Monday morning application. Let's say that I come into you and say, you know, I'm just so mad at so-and-so next door. He insulted me and da 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 da, and I can't go punch him out because, you know, I don't want to cause a problem there, but I don't know what to do, and I'm just so mad I can't see straight, and I come in to see you. I don't know what kind of advice you give me about that.
Okay.
When we get back there. By the way, your guitar, I do want to talk to you about that a little bit. I don't know too many pastors that put out solo guitar albums. I'm really pretty impressed, I got to tell you.
Thank you.
In fact, I think I'm going to hold it up to my pastor as an example and say, look what you should be doing. and see how that goes. Let me remind everyone that we're here every Saturday morning at 11 o'clock right here on Atlanta's Biz 1190. And today's program is always podcast on eddiemayfield.com. By the way, you can find me at, just write me at eddie@eddiemayfield.com. My business web is emainc.net, who is the sponsor of today's program. We'll be right back with a final segment with Dr. David Cooper. Stick around. Welcome back to the final segment of today's Driven to Business. We're talking with Dr. David C. Cooper. Dr. Cooper is the lead pastor at Mount Perrin Church here in the Atlanta area. He's the author of a number of books, but most recently a book entitled Unfinished Business. You can find that on Amazon.com. And he also has a guitar CD out right now called Flying Solo, and that's also on Amazon. I'm sure some other places. Dr. Cooper, before we end the program, I do want to talk to you about that guitar CD, because I was listening to that just before the program today, as a matter of fact, and it really is interesting. Tell us about your guitar playing.
Well, I started music when I was second grade, played trumpet, then drums, and I studied guitar formally, jazz guitarist, and I perform a lot of solo guitar instrumental pieces now, and that's what that album is. I also played lead guitar with a Christian band, Open Door. We got one of our new songs. Mike Parker and I, who have that band, Glorious, is now being aired on the radio around the country. So,
wow.
Music's just a wonderful gift for me. I've always loved music, so it's great to be able to have a way to express that and share that.
Let me get your opinion about this. Our worship pastor, when we're doing sound checks at our church, he always, it's like, okay, Andrew's doing, the other guitar player's playing, and he'll say, turn Andrew up a little bit, and then, the bass player, turn Keith up a little bit, and he always says, oh, turn Eddie down a little more there. What do you think?
I think you're a rocker, so you want it turned up loud.
Now, I do have the opportunity to play at Mountain Park Baptist I think I told you during the break, I'm the token old guy in the worship band there, and I do really enjoy it. Your album is very good, and it's a great mix of music. I would encourage anybody to go and check that out. And Isaac, he was telling me how you do play there at the church quite a bit. Hey, talk just a moment to us about the fear of change. It's something I wanted to bring up and probably should have brought up earlier in the program, but people do fear change, don't they?
Absolutely. The reason for that is it's unpredictable. We don't know what change will bring, and that's what frightens us. The present, even if we don't like the present, we know what to expect.
Right.
But when change is introduced on the table, we don't know what that's going to look like. It's unpredictable, the outcome of change. Remember when Coke changed to New Coke back in wherever it was 4 years ago?
Oh, yeah.
Well, they did a research team. They thought that was going to work, but that backfired in a big way.
Right.
And that's what's frightening about change. We may all believe it's going to lead to something great, but we don't really know until we do it. And it may make things worse than better. And it's the unpredictability of the outcomes of change that make it very difficult for us.
But, at some point in our careers, we live in a rapidly changing world. And I know as a pastor especially, you face this in some ways. We may be afraid of change, but we have, there are things going to change whether we like it or not. So, I'll tell people about technology. Technology rarely goes back in the box, once it's out. So you better learn to live with it.
I give you a different way of looking at that. I don't think things are changes as much as they are. Those are small micro changes.
Right.
For example, I noticed a railroad train the other day, and I thought, man, they've been doing this since the 1800s.
Right.
So the automobile's been around a long time. They may change the style, the political structure of America, the economic structure of America. Not much really changes. And you think, and people talk a lot about change, but if you can look at society in a little different way and think, not changing that much. I mean, since the day we had a telephone, we still have a telephone. It's a little different. We got the computer, the camera, the phone all in one little box. But the fact is we've been using these tools a long time. But change the whole American economy to a socialist economy. Find out how easy that is to do.
Right.
So doing a mega change, I don't think that's true. I think the changes we're going through are actually very small, and micro changes, macro changes are very, very rare.
I do think that we live in very, very exciting times in terms of, as a person that's involved in marketing a business, we have such a plethora of marketing venues. I know that as a church, we have to be careful using the term marketing so much, but getting a message out is really the way I view marketing. And there are a lot of ways of doing it. In fact, one of the problems becomes how do you do it? Because most of us, I think as an American society, one thing that's happened to us is we've all seen so much spam in our lives, both as email and as other messages that we're just bombarded with. We all sort of start putting up little filters. And I think, I know at our church, we talk with this a lot. And in our business, we deal with a lot. How do we pierce through the noise that's out there and get our message out to our prospects? And I think that's just part of it. But, these are exciting times and we should do it. You just can't sit back on in your rocking chair and hope it's going to happen. You've really got to give it some thought and work.
Yes. Any success is intentional. And I think in the church world, we should decide whether we're marketing our church or marketing Jesus. Those are two different things.
You're right.
Whether we're trying to get people to come to a church or we're trying to get people to come to the Lord, those are two different things. And also in business and church, I think it's true that the word of mouth, a person who's excited about your business or your restaurant or the church they go to is still the best advertisement you have.
Absolutely.
And so that's another one of those things that really hasn't changed in several thousand years. You get one person who's excited, who goes and tells their family, their friends, and brings them with them, is still the way that most businesses and churches grow. Now, the marketing, the images, you know, the emails, that can introduce a person. But it's the personal touch and the personal service that really, I think, makes people lasting customers or church members.
You know, I mentioned Malcolm Gladwell earlier. He wrote another book called Tipping Point. It's about how little things become big things. It's of interest to any of us involved in sales. And he has an interesting thing in the last chapter where he says is with all these messages we have and all the methods, and I agree with him and disagree with him a little bit. He said that we are re-entering the age of word of mouth. I happen to agree with you. I don't think we've ever left the age of word of mouth. It's just, in fact, I think it counts more now than ever. We've used example here before on the program. You know, I've used example of some other guests. You know, if I want to go eat lunch around here, and there's a gazillion restaurants right here in the Buckhead area, and so, but I ask Isaac sitting over here where I should go eat lunch. Well, what Isaac says probably outweighs any ads I saw or any radio ads I heard or anything else. If Isaac said, oh, that place down there is really great, that's probably what I'm going to do. And I think you're absolutely right, word of mouth. And also, we go back into the church, you had to have a personal testimony.
Absolutely.
Nothing trumps that in terms of it. Hey, I know you've heard this before around church. I certainly have. And, you know, we all have a tendency, you know, we talk about minor surgery only happens to other people. You know, like, you know, if I'm having surgery, it's not minor, I can tell you that. And I think when we're talking about these unfinished business items that you've been talking about, you know, it's easier perhaps to put some of those and say, oh, big deal or boss yelled at her. But, you know, that little thing can be a very big deal to somebody, the person it happened to.
That's what I meant by the word respect. When I value your experience and feelings as much as my own, I become a true friend to you.
Right.
If I demean you or say, it's not important, get over it, that's a very demeaning type of response.
Right.
But being able to value other people's opinions, views, experiences, love your neighbor as yourself. You know, it's okay to have your opinion, your view. That's great. Be passionate about it. But show an equal value for other people's view and opinion.
That, again, that hasn't really changed since the days of Jesus, has it? You were talking about change. Well, that's exactly how it was, the same way back when Christ walked the earth.
Yes, the human experience does not change. There, like I said, there's not a lot has changed. I mean, we have more democratic nations than we used to have totalitarian governments,
right,
you know, under Greeks or Romans. We have,
right.
There are certain changes like that. But we're still wearing clothes, we're still having fashion, we still have music, some form of communication, some form of travel. It may become more sophisticated, but the basics of the human experience remain constant.
Exactly, and still many of us have the same motivation, good or bad. You know, the motivation
Absolutely.
To succeed, the motivation, even I hate to say it, the motivation to sin, which we can have, has never changed in all those years. David, thank you so much for coming on the program. You've been a great guest. Thank you for your time. I know you're a busy man.
Not busy, but I'm trying to be productive, trying to accomplish something. It's an honor to be invited today.
Well, thank you. Let me remind everyone again that you can find David's book, Unfinished Business, on Amazon.com, and also check out his guitar CD, Flying Solo, there as well. David, thanks for coming. You've been listening to Driven to Two Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. We'll see you again next week.
You've been listening to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Visit next Saturday at 11 a.m. on Biz 1190 for more Driven to Business. To learn more about Driven to Business, visit eddiemayfield.com or call 770-448-4644.